Hey everyone, this is the On Science podcast from NPR News. I'm Andrew Prince, a web producer with the Science Desk. In this week's podcast, we'll check in with NPR's Robert Krulwich. He explains, in the usual Krulwichian fashion, how bees decide what's the best place to move their hive. Researchers are trying to study if electrons really are perfect spheres, and we'll find out how a country's cultural rules have roots in war, disease, and other challenges. But first, we'll turn to news of the tornadoes in the Midwest this week. So far this year, there have been nearly 1,200 tornadoes in the U.S. That's close to twice the usual number, and it comes as something of a surprise to the scientists who study them. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, that's because there's still no good way to predict tornado outbreaks more than a couple of days ahead of time.
Every year, government meteorologists tell the public about how many hurricanes to expect during the Atlantic season. But the government doesn't do that with tornadoes. Howie Bluestein, a meteorologist at the University of Oklahoma, says there's a good reason.
I would say we have no skill in predicting whether the coming season will be good or bad, depending on your perspective, for tornadoes.
Bluestein says even in the midst of a very busy year like this one, there's no way to know what's likely to happen even a few weeks from now.
This could be it for the rest of the season, or it could continue to be crazy. We absolutely don't know. Our predictability is not that good.
Bluestein says one reason is that a tornado season can change dramatically in just a few days if the conditions are right. The right conditions usually involve severe thunderstorms in an area where warm and cold air are colliding. Near Joplin yesterday, the conditions also included a type of thunderstorm called a supercell, which has a powerful rotating updraft. This year, conditions like that produced more than 300 tornadoes in just 3 days at the end of April. Bluestein says that's a fairly typical length of time for an outbreak.
Oftentimes, an extreme event will occur. It will last for a short period of time, and that will be a spike.
Bluestein says spikes are hard to predict, and they aren't necessarily part of a larger seasonal trend. There's also no solid evidence that tornadoes have been influenced by climate change. In some ways, tornadoes are a lot like hurricanes, which are easier to predict. Both are violent, rotating storms that can produce winds of more than 100 miles per hour. But Greg Jenkins from the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Howard University says that's where the similarities end.
The time scales are different, the space scales are different, and the sources are different.
Jenkins says that while tornadoes depend on local or regional weather conditions, hurricanes are affected by climate conditions that cover a large chunk of the globe.
Hurricanes are coming generally from West Africa. That there's a disturbance that's crossing the western part of Africa. It goes out over the ocean, and then 1 out of 10 may become hurricanes.
Whether they do or do not develop can depend on things like sea surface temperatures in the Atlantic or winds shaped by El Niño or La Niña conditions thousands of miles away. And because these patterns occur on such a large scale, Jenkins says, they tend to change slowly over months or years.
Tornadoes, on the other hand, are much smaller scale. And so often one sees a pattern that might persist for, you know, several days or a week. You know, lots of air, warm, moist air streaming up from the Gulf of Mexico. And then we get this big outbreak of tornadic thunderstorms.
Jenkins says that because those patterns only last for a few days, meteorologists' predictions are limited to that same short time span. Jenkins says another factor is that even a big tornado, like the one that hit Joplin, is rarely more than a mile across. That's not at all like a hurricane.
The difference is the hurricane can stretch out for 300, 400, 500, 1,000 miles in the case of really big ones like Rita some years ago.
Forecasters had been tracking Rita for more than a week as it slowly crossed the Atlantic. The tornado in Joplin had existed for only about 20 minutes when it hit the city. But thanks to improvements in short-term prediction, government scientists did provide some warning that a tornado was possible. At least 24 hours earlier, a map produced by the U.S. Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma, showed a red zone surrounding Joplin. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is the moving season. Kids are leaving college, families are taking vacations, and if you look in your backyard, you may see some bees hunting for real estate. Here's NPR's science correspondent, Robert Krulwich.
It starts with a hum. You might hear it in the woods, or maybe in your backyard. In springtime, says Cornell professor Tom Seeley, a beehive gets very crowded, so often a bunch of bees will split off, led by the queen, And the first thing they're going to need is a new home. So they've got to choose one. But how they choose, that's the big surprise. It turns out that bees vote. And Tom Seeley has figured out how they do it.
They fly out of the parental hive, and it's a mass exodus. And then they reassemble. Once they're outside, they assemble themselves into a beard-like cluster. It's about the size of a soccer ball.
A beard-like cluster? So it means that they look like a beard?
Yeah, if Santa Claus had a dark brown beard, that's what it would look like. It hangs from a tree branch, and it kind of sways around a little bit like a beard would blow around.
And when they're swarming, at this point, they're gentle, right? They don't sting you if you try to touch them?
Yes, you can go up to them. You can put your finger in the cluster and feel how warm it is inside. We do all sorts of stuff. Like, you can even do scientific investigations of them.
Okay, so let us ask, what are the bees now looking for? Well, Tom says they need a hole in a tree high off the ground, lots of space inside, narrow opening, facing in the right direction.
So they've got a real problem. Finding first-rate living quarters is not easy for honeybees.
And it turns out they don't have any, you know, bee instinct that says, here's the place. The queen is not involved at all. Instead,
The bees that go looking, and we call these nest site scouts, they are among the oldest and probably the most experienced bees in the swarm.
And they're a small group, you say, about 5% of the hive. So how many bees is that? 5%?
So that would be about 300 to 500. Oh. So that's a sizable search committee.
Yes. Yeah. So imagine you're a scout. You're all female. So off you go, wandering the forest. You pass an elm tree, then a beech tree, then an oak tree. Then on the oak tree, you see a nice-looking hole. So you enter, you look around. And then after your inspection?
What you will do at that point is you will come back to the swarm cluster, and there you will perform a waggle dance.
That's a classic dance in the style of a figure eight done by honeybees. And what the waggle dance says is, it's here, it's here, to find it you gotta go here. It's here, it's here, to find it you gotta go north by northwest, 120 degrees by the dandelions and the rhododendrons.
That's it, yep. Then she runs right around again, back to the starting point, and does another one over and over again. And she's indicating the direction and distance to the site that she discovered. I should mention, she spent about 30 minutes checking out that site. She's measured all the relevant properties of the site. It's as if she ranks it on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being tops. When she gets back to the swarm, if it's a 10, she might do 300 of these dance circuits, which might take 10 minutes. But if it's only mediocre, let's say it's a 3, she might only do 30 of the dance circuits, which could only take a minute or two. And so the better she thinks her site is, the longer, the more persistently she will dance to advertise that site.
And the more she dances, the more the other scout bees back at the swarm, they get to see the dance. So now they have directions, and they can also visit the same site.
Exactly. If you're only dancing 1 minute, it might only be maybe 5 or 6 bees that can get the message. If you're dancing 10 minutes, it might be 50 or 60 bees that can get your message.
So if they like the site, then they come back and they dance the same dance, and dancers beget more dancers and more dancers, and that's how they vote. Eventually, one dance wins.
This process tends to snowball.
But here's a question. Do they end up making the right choice? I mean,
We know that they do choose well. That was an important question to address.
He knows because he ran an experiment. He built 5 nest-like boxes and placed them near a beehive in Maine.
And of those 5, one of them will be an excellent home site. It'll be a box with 40 liters of space.
And that's just perfect size. So over and over, and year after year, he let the bees choose a box, which they did.
And overall, it's probably 90 to 95% of the time they choose the best box.
That surprises me, you know, because I would think if you got a really persuasive but misguided, you know, an Adolf Hitler bee. So she's like fabulously good at speaking, and she gives the best wiggle dances, and everybody follows her to hell. So they all go to the worst possible site. Why doesn't that happen?
The reason that doesn't happen, Robert, is that scout bees do not blindly follow one very enthusiastic dancer.
In fact, these bees, they don't follow anybody, he says.
Each of those bees makes her own independent evaluation of that site. And only if the bee judges that that site really is good will she herself then come back to the swarm and advertise it.
So there are checks and balances here.
That's right. That's a key part of this whole process.
So no Hitlers, no bullies, no queen telling you how to vote. The scouts just dance themselves into a kind of voting consensus.
And that's certainly how it works here. This demonstrates that democracy really does work.
Well, there's one little sneaky thing that nature gave these bees that you just haven't mentioned.
That's right.
What about a bee who's absolutely convinced that she's got the best site and the majority wants an oak tree, she wants an elm tree, and she's thinking, no, I will never, ever, ever give up.
We haven't seen any bees like that.
Really?
That's correct. In the world of scout bees, you don't have diehard bees that just dance and dance and dance forever.
So what do they do?
A bee puts forth her opinion for a while, as expressed in her dance, and then she goes quiet. It's what I call the retire and rest.
So she'll do 300 dances for her elm tree, and then when she's done, all the passion just kind of disappears. It's like water going down a drain.
Yes, that's it. Yep.
And this is genetic. It's built in?
That's built in. And when you think about it, that works really well because it kind of clears the decks.
I'll say there's now you don't have fanatics.
Because those fanatics, they're kind of gumming up the works. Huh. They're keeping an idea going beyond the point at which it's actually useful.
On the other hand, you can't get a principled bee. What you get, actually, is animals who deep in their DNA have a nature that favors consensus.
Yes, each bee's behavior is tuned, is designed, has been shaped by natural selection to make the swarm a good decision-making body.
And do you find yourself admiring these bees?
Oh, tremendously. In fact, I admire them so much, I've used some of the things that I've learned to organize committee meetings.
Like what kind of things?
We had a very big debate. Uh-huh. Didn't come to a conclusion. And the chairman turned to me and said, well, Tom, what would the bees do? And I'd have to say, well, Greg,
bees aren't ever fanatics like some professors we know.
Yeah, that's right. I prefer to say they're not stubborn.
Well, that's a much better way to say it. Tom Seeley's bee studies appear in his book, Honey Bee Democracy. Robert Milwich, NPR News.
When school kids make models of atoms and they have to represent the electrons whizzing around the atom's nucleus, they usually reach for things like ping pong balls, round things. But are electrons really spheres? The answer to that question has important implications for understanding the nature of our universe. And as NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, scientists have made their best effort yet to discern the shape of these subatomic particles.
This new method of determining the shape of an electron is so precise that it boggles the mind. Johnny Hudson is a physicist at Imperial College London. He says, just imagine if you took a teeny electron and enlarged it to the size of the solar system.
We've measured its shape with an accuracy equivalent to that of one human hair. It's a stupendously accurate measurement. You can't even think about how accurate it is. I think it's got a lot of decimal places.
It took six people a dozen years to do it. They developed a measuring system that uses red and green lasers. It gives their lab an unearthly glow. And inside their apparatus, they created a special molecule that is orbited by a single lonely electron.
We then take the molecule and then we send it into a region where we have some electrically charged plates.
The test was to see if the electron would start to wobble, because that would tell them how round it really was.
To give you an analogy, right, if I put a perfect spherical ball on my desk, it wouldn't flop over one way or the other because it's a perfect sphere. Every way up is just as good. Whereas if I put an egg on my desk, it would fall over onto its side. And so it's just the same thing. It's if the electron's not round, then any force on the electron might make it turn.
They checked this not once, but about 25 million times. And in order to be really precise, they had to shield this sensitive experiment from very tiny interferences that could mess it up. How tiny?
The example I always like to give is, if you think hard, then all the neurons in your brain fire. And actually, if you put a magnetic field sensor on your head, you can detect that change in magnetic field. And actually, that change in magnetic field would be enough to completely ruin our experiment.
So do you all just make sure that you don't think during your experiment?
We just absolutely no thinking in the lab is the rule, yeah.
That's a joke, obviously. One thing that was forbidden in the lab for a long time was seeing the results. Hudson and his colleagues had their computer system hide the data to make sure the team stayed unbiased. Then, one day, they all gathered in an office, hit a button, and finally learned the answer.
As best we can tell, you know, to our experimental precision, the electron seems to be round.
The result is reported in the journal Nature, and it isn't just a bit of esoteric trivia. Hudson says many theorists don't want the electron to be round. It throws off their calculations. They're counting on a slightly aspherical electron to explain things like why antimatter has pretty much disappeared since the creation of the universe billions of years ago. And Hudson says, as physicists take their best shot at developing a grand theory of everything,
they almost always predict that the electron won't be round, that actually it should be noticeably distorted.
Now, it's possible that even this new experiment was still not sensitive enough to detect that distortion. Dave DeMille is a professor of physics at Yale University.
It's fantastically impressive that they've been able to make this measurement more precise than it has been before.
But he says we need something even more precise. DeMille says what's exciting to him is that this is a new way of probing an electron's shape. He has some ideas for tweaking the approach.
We and a few other experiments are projecting that we might be able to get sensitivity that's a factor of 100, 1,000, maybe even in the long term, 10,000 times better.
And he says pushing it that much further should reveal any bulges or dents that would make the theorists happy. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Countries tend to have personalities, just like people do. Researchers set out to define those differences using a scale that measures how tight the social rules and standards are. The result is published in Science magazine, and it finds that cultural rules, as simple as when and where it's appropriate to kiss, are often shaped by a nation's experience with war, disease, and other challenges. But there are some surprises, too. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The idea for this study really dates back to the 1960s. Back then, an anthropologist decided to evaluate a few dozen obscure, in fact, dead, cultures and see if he could rank them on a scale from tight to loose. He defined tight cultures as having lots of rules, which people violate at their peril. Loose cultures are more relaxed in their expectations and more forgiving of people who deviate. Fast forward now to Michelle Gelfand, a psychology professor at the University of Maryland.
This research that we did across 33 nations was the first to show the distinction applies to modern nations.
She and a large group of international colleagues developed a survey that they asked nearly 7,000 people worldwide to answer.
So, for example, you might have been asked, you know, how appropriate is it to curse in the bank or kiss in a public park or eat or read a newspaper in a classroom? And we were able to derive scores of how constrained in general situations are versus how much they have latitude in different countries.
They developed a measure for the 33 countries they studied and then cross-checked their findings with expert opinions and other methods. Most of them matched pretty well with common experience.
Some of the cultures that are quite tight in our sample include places like Singapore, Japan, Pakistan, whereas many loose societies include countries like New Zealand, the Netherlands, United States.
The researchers then dug in to see if they could figure out why nations are relatively tight or relatively loose. And history was a pretty good guide. Embattled countries tended to have tighter social rules, so did nations dealing with disease and a history of crowding.
In fact, the data show that population density in the year 1500 predicts tightness today.
That makes sense. Cultures all squeezed together, like in Japan, have a strong incentive to be cooperative. Curiously enough, wealth doesn't seem to matter. Well-off Norway, for instance, ranks as relatively tight, not so off from India, which is much poorer. And not all countries are true to type. Gelfand was surprised to find that Israel, which is under threat from its neighbors and its desert environment, is still culturally loose. Gelfand suspects that's in part because lots of Israelis came from relatively loose cultures in Eastern Europe.
It's also a culture of argumentation, debate, dissent that really is very much consistent with Judaism. And these things all promote looseness.
Now, these results raise all sorts of questions, the biggest one being what's cause and what's effect.
That's the million-dollar question. At this point, we can't be sure.
Ara Nurenzayan at the University of British Columbia says there's a lively debate about the extent to which cultures are shaped by the environment, how much they are shaped by our genes, and how much cultures are simply passed down from one generation to the next. While academics wrestle with those issues, Nurenzayan says the results from Michelle Gelfand's study can be useful for people struggling to solve the world's problems collectively.
For example, coming into some kind of agreement on how to combat global warming involves coordination of dozens of countries.
And it helps to understand each country's cultural perspective when seeking common ground. Richard Harris, NPR News.
That's it for the Science Podcast this week. You can find these stories and all the coverage from the NPR Science Desk at our website, npr.org/science. We'll be back with more next week.